I think we'll review some things in general about the alcoholic tonight. And since we have one or two new people, I would like to remind you that you come to the Little Hill Foundation, Little Hill Alena Lodge, because you have a problem with drinking and or mood changers. We do not come here for a rest. We do not come here to be entertained. We do not come here to be soothed. We come here to look at ourselves. And I want to start tonight by quoting from an article by a Pennsylvania pastor at a seminar on alcoholism. And he describes the alcoholic. He says, "The alcoholic is an adult with a child's sense of values. What comes easily to others, he can do only with a great amount of inner stress and anxiety." And most of us, when we come to the doors of a rehabilitation center or to a hospital, are filled with stress and anxiety. Not one of you came here without being shaking on the inside. You may have presented a smiley face, but I know how you felt because I know how I felt. And it's not easy. For in alcohol, we found that medicine which put our anxieties to sleep and liberated us from guilt and failure. This was our medicine. Then comes the time when even alcohol betrays us. It is no longer useful. This pastor went on to say that when the bottle betrays the man or the woman who's drinking it and no longer helps, he is now less able to face the stresses of life than he was when he first started drinking. At the end of our drinking, we've lost even some of the natural ability we had to face stress. He has a sense of lost time and wonders if he will ever be able to catch up. And isn't that what some of you are thinking now? How am I going to make up for this lost time? Now more than ever, there is the drive, the desire to do it all right, everything right, we want to do, to wring out of life the satisfaction that we have missed. And this is an impossible task. Frequently, men are terrified at the prospect of taking a new job because they're certain they're going to louse it up. All through stress and anxiety, all in living tomorrow. The person who feels that they're going to be a failure needs to learn to succeed and to fail without flying to extremes of elation or despair. Because we don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. In essence, he needs to grow up because the normal adult faces ups and downs every day of their life. As immature people, we leap on a horse and ride off in a million directions. You go home and you try to do everything at once. Instead of saying, "I will do one small thing at a time." My brother gave me some very good advice when I came around. He suggested that my life was pretty full of problems, and believe me, it was. And he said, "You know, if you had a dishpan full of potatoes, You'd peel them one at a time. You better do this with your problem. You better not try to handle them all at once. You better not try to peel every potato one at a time. But do it one at a time. And take a potato to start out with that looks about your size. Don't take the biggest one in the lot and be clumsy and drop it on your foot and say, oh, well, I never was even good at peeling potatoes. Don't try to do everything at once. Some of the signs of maturity are, first, do what you have to do. And right here you can start this. You can show some signs of growing up. Every day there's some things you have to do. You have to get up in the morning, and you better get up and get on time, and you better follow the directions, and you better make your bed, and you better do some things. There's some things you have to do. And then second, do what you ought to do. Like sew a button back on your dress, fix a shoelace, write a card home. Don't put off writing the letters. Do some of these things that you ought to do. Even if you only write 3 lines, waste a 6-cent stamp. Be the last of the big spenders. You know, I'm going to wait to write a letter until I can write a real letter and get it all in one envelope. Well, let's do some of the things we ought to do. Because if you do what you have to do, and you do what you ought to do today, then you will have done what you wanted to do in the first place. Be a responsible person. Maturity is facing things and handling criticism one day at a time. If you're growing, you must relinquish your right to be so miserable. We have a habit pattern of being in poor health and griping and bitching and feeling badly and sad all the time. Let's give up being so miserable. You don't have to do it to show somebody you're sorry. You don't have to write home in sackcloth and ashes just because you've had a little too much to drink. There must be something good about you, or somebody wouldn't have brought you up here. There are some less expensive places, and there are some places that would be glad to accept you as a charge of the state for a slight fee. They also charge $65 a week in New Jersey, and that stunned me no end. I thought we got there for nothing. But try to realize that there must be something good about you, and you don't have to say, oh, beat your breast, I'm so sorry, I'm an alcoholic. Certainly you're an alcoholic. Certainly you've done a lot of things that you shouldn't do. But you have a brand new day and a chance to start again. Maturity is acceptance. Accept things as you find them. Not as they should be, but as they are. Begin to know your limitations and set some goals that are within your reach. Maturity might be defined as humility, honesty, helpfulness. Now, humility, again, is not running around in sackcloth and ashes, but it's rather in having a good estimate of what you're worth as a person, good and bad, having a good estimate of what you're worth as a person, a real understanding of who you are and what you are, both good and bad. This is humility. Oh, we go around falsely and say, oh, I'm terrible. I'm the worst person in the world. Baloney. I can find worse people than you are, not if I look real hard. Maturity is honesty. And in honesty, you must take your inventory. And again, you must be honest about your good points as well as your bad. Because if you don't, you're not going to be able to survive. I urge you to do your inventory and find out what's good about you first. And hold on to those things with a death grip. If you've got a good sense of humor, for heaven's sake, hold on to it. If you smile once in a while, hold on to it. If you comb your hair every morning, hold on to it. Don't go around looking like something out of a dish mop. I saw a couple people yesterday when their family visited. I'm telling you, they never looked like that at dinner here. And they better not look like that when their family comes again either. Because this is a form of self-pity. Poor me. I'm not very well. And I'm sure not very well. And you're not going to be very well unless you stand up and be counted. But I'm going to hit you. Perhaps not physically. But I can do a lot more damage with this mouth of mine than I ever did with a stick. I never was very good with a stick. The third thing in maturity is helpfulness. And helpfulness is a program of action. Do something. Make notes. Take notes. Listen to somebody bitch if they have to. They've got to bitch to somebody without repeating it. I am hearing the most marvelous gossip around here that I ever heard. The last thing I heard was that Peter was going to come over and live with me at Merkel Hall. And don't hold your breath until that happens. Peter, I wouldn't be that mean to you. Honest, I wouldn't.
Already
does. Huh? You, I'm talking about. I thought, well, I've heard everything now. I just decided maybe Peter was going to take my room and bath. I didn't know. Don't bother gossiping about what I can do. I can take care of my own affairs very well. I've been doing it for quite a while. And I don't need your help, nor your counsel, nor your interest. And this is part of growing up. To learn to handle your own affairs. And if you do that well, you've done a great job. And gossip is not healthy. Sometimes we talk about other people helpfully to try to help them. But gossip for gossip's sake. Do you know who's going to do what? Do you know what Mrs. Delaney said about so-and-so? Well, you don't know. But certainly it goes around here like wildfire. I've heard everything about who's going to move over to Merkel Hall. And when I make up my mind, I'll let you know, too. You know, that'll be real easy. I don't mind letting you know because the decisions are made by me here. Not by the staff, not by the guests, not by time, but by the manner in which I think an individual can be best handled. Now, I may be wrong, but I have to make decisions and I have to stand on my decision and I have to accept the consequences of the same. This is part of maturity, is facing responsibility, of making decisions to the best of your ability with the facts at hand, and hoping that you are able to stand the consequences of your decision. I think decision making is one of the things that we have to learn because we have tried to walk that tightrope and not really make any decisions and sort of force other people into making them. This is what happens here when people keep trying to have personal interviews with me. They want me to make their decisions for them. This is the place where you learn to make decisions for yourself. And one of the ways you make them is to take a single problem out of your life and write down all of the possibilities, all of the possible answers to a given problem. And alongside of each possible answer, you put the good points and the bad points. And when you look over all those bad points, if you can't take the worst that will happen, you better not make that decision, because the law of averages means that it may go bad. And you must be able to take that. If you can take the worst thing that could happen, then go ahead. And anything past that is a plus. Part of maturing is to realize that we must live and let live. That we can't change everybody around us. Even if they're wrong, we can't change them. The members of your family may be wrong right down the line. Your boss, your employee, you cannot change everybody else. You must change yourself. When I first came around and I looked at this AA prayer, I thought, oh dear me, there are so many things I have to accept. Oh dear. And there's so few things I can change. There's only one thing I have to accept that I can't possibly change, and that is my intolerance to alcohol and mood changes. This is never going to change because it always gets worse. It never gets better. I had a call today from a young man who's been trying to prove that I was wrong. He was here for alcohol and medication, and he stayed off of them 5 years. But during his 5 years, he's been coming up a couple of times a year to give me an argument. He went to Columbia and he got his PhD, and I'm sure he spent all his time there trying to figure out how he could lick his intolerance to alcohol. And he would come out and present me with all these facts out of the literature. And I was very glad that he was so learned, but I kept assuring him that it wouldn't work. And so he stopped by here last night, a little bit bombed. And he called up this afternoon, wouldn't I just see him for 5 minutes? I said, you got a little trouble with your pills and alcohol, Al? Yeah. Your theories don't work. No. What are you going to do about it? Well, I thought maybe in 5 minutes you could tell me. I said, I've told you everything I know. Don't. Your tolerance gets less. Now, he's nibbled along since May. And he thought he had it licked. He thought he could prove. But it got out of hand this weekend. And he never got to Wilkes-Barre. He never got farther than the inn over here in Blairstown. And he wants me to do something about his problem. I can't take any time off, says he. And I can't stop. Can't you do something about it, Jerry? I can't do anything about it. Because he's turned on that trigger. And you turn it on with the first one. You may not get drunk, but it will go on to completion eventually. And part of maturity, part of growing up, is to be willing to look at the other person's viewpoint, to look at the winner and say, how did you do it? And follow it blindly whether you think it'll work or not. I almost lost my life because before I was willing to look. Because I thought I could do it myself. I knew that I knew more than anyone in the world. I was omnipotent. But I finally had to look at some of my abilities realistically. In one of them, I didn't know what I was talking about when it came to addiction to alcohol and mood changes. And this was 23 years ago. And I had to be beaten to my knees before I could understand that my decisions were not always right. But that I would have another chance if I wanted it. And here comes the thing in maturity that we need more than anyone thinks. And that flexibility of thought and action. When we see we're going in the wrong direction, we must be flexible enough to change. If you're going down the middle of the road and there's a boulder there, you don't run over it. You walk around it or you turn around it in the car. But we see the boulders in our lives. And somehow or other, we think we can make it. One of the girls the other day brought me a little turtle pin. And I'd forgotten about the turtle. John Park Lee, at a meeting last year, pointed out that the turtle on top of the big rock didn't get there without help. And we have to have help if we're going to grow. Because we need a helping hand. We're going to have to learn to survive some discomfort. And that's pretty hard for us because we were addicted to comfort before we were addicted to alcohol. And how are we going to avoid going back down the road of discomfort? Well, there are a number of ways. I think pride is probably our biggest roadblock to lasting sobriety. We hate to admit, even to ourselves, the total extent of our past failures and the actual true state of our present affairs. We have hidden it from ourselves so long that we're afraid to even look at it ourselves. Because we think if we look at it, maybe somebody else will know it. And I've got news for you. Everybody knows it but us. We're the very last to know about our failures. We're the very last to know the real state of our present affairs. We are constantly wearing a false front. And we've worn it for so long that it's hard to crack through. That's why time is so important here. But if you don't be careful, you will hold on to it through all your time here. And the first thing you know, you'll be going home and you won't have cracked that heavy veneer called false pride. our personal dishonesty, our rationalization, just plain lying, if you will. Is a real block to sobriety and comfort. The quarter turning that we do is so easy. That fuzzing of the picture, that not telling all, that I don't remember, or the changing of words. So-and-so told me. It's very easy to put into other people's mouths the words we want to hear. My wife said, my doctor said, and what comes out of your mouth isn't anything like the things that were said. And part of this is because we are still holding false pride. We don't want to say, look, I'm sick of this place, I want to go home. Well, I'd be surprised if you weren't sick of it. We don't aim to make you so comfortable that you want to spend your life here, because we like a change of faces, too. I don't like to look at you all the time. I'd like to look at you for a while, and then I'd like to have you go home and have you come back and tell me how wonderful it is. But I don't want you to go home and come back drinking again. And yet some of you will. Some of you will never have the chance to come back, because you're going to be material for the mental institution with one more drunk. I've seen it happen too often. And I tell you, before you leave, what your chances are. And some of you think I'm pretty brutal in telling you this, but I love you enough to be honest with you, to make some attempt to get through that veneer of false pride, so that you will see the present state of your affairs. Because we're not interested in what you did before. You can't take back a single word. You can't undo a single deed that you did yesterday or in 100 yesterdays. But you can do something about today. If you will. If you will follow directions, as the man in Florida said. Just follow the simple directions. Here we call it putting the flowers in the vase upside down. Do as you're told. If I tell you to put the flowers face down, put them there. It's good self-discipline, if nothing else. In false pride, we seem unable to accept the advice of others. Primarily because we don't want to admit defeat. You know, the Father Quinn in his tape says, I will do it myself, Mama. His or her majesty, the baby, kicking their feet on the floor. I know how to do it. I am an adult. When somebody told me I was immature after I came around, I liked to have a cotton-picking fit. Well, yes, I had a lot of education, and the body is grown up. As a matter of fact, it was 165 pounds about that thing. It was pretty well developed. But emotionally, I was still behaving just like I did as a youngster when I stamped my feet and screamed bloody murder in anger. I didn't scream out loud, but I screamed in. And for us, this makes for discomfort the like of which we never had when we were able to yell and stamp our feet. You know, it'd be a little better if we could yell and stamp our feet. I have some friends. I have one friend, non-alcoholic, and every time she gets mad, she's got a pile of old dishes that she flings at the wall. And you know, I envy her because I certainly would like to do that. Someday I hope to be able to throw dishes at somebody's wall, mine, if I don't dent it, but you know, I've got a lovely stone wall over there at Merkle Hall. It'd be a wonderful place to throw dishes if I could just get the consent of my soul to do it. If I could get relaxed enough to throw dishes when I'm mad, I think I will have made it. Because this is not the worst thing in the world. Providing you don't hit your husband in the head. Or your wife. Or your child. I can distinctly remember my mother getting mad at me. And she was telling me what a low life I was. And like all fresh kids, I said, well, after all, I'm your daughter. And with that, I ducked. And she hit my father in the face with a plate. And I was his only daughter. Well, you can imagine what a family feud started then. And I marched off in high glee. So I don't recommend that. I really don't. But I do recommend some way in which you can let out your hostility without harming someone else. Sometimes false pride will not let us join Alcoholics Anonymous. We're not quite that bad. Well, you know something? The people in AA have at least done something about your drinking. And up until the time you join AA, you haven't done much about yours. Oh, yes, you stopped lots of times. You're like Noel Coward. You stopped hundreds of times, but you always start. And sometimes our false pride will keep us from accepting a job, any kind of a job, you know. I was out of a job, and when I went back, I wrote my resume, and my resume looks real good. It really does. Funny part, I couldn't get a job. Nobody could understand what I was doing out of a job. And of course, I failed to tell them that there was a little matter of drinking too much and taking too much medication. False pride wouldn't let me do that after all. And an old German helped me. I went down an ironbound, and I was applying for a secretary's job at $50 a week. And I'd been making $500 a week in my expenses. And I can see his face today. And he stuck out his jaw at me and he said, what's the matter with you? And I said, nothing. What's the matter with you? And he just screamed at me. I said, I'm an alcoholic. He said, why don't you say so? And he said, with a resume like this, nobody hire you. You wouldn't stay anyway. And he did me a great favor. The next resume I sent out, you would have thought I had been doing nothing but secretarial work all my life. But even then, I couldn't get a job. I think the Lord knew what he was doing when he made it a little difficult for me. And I finally had to put out my hand to a friend and say, will you help me? And this was the man who was to lead me to the wonderful things that I have been allowed to do in the chronic illness field. But we have to drop our false pride and ask for help. People cannot help us in big ways or little ways unless we say, I need help. Help me. And you'd be surprised where you'll get help and how much you'll get if you put out an open hand. But if you continue to do it your way, you're going to continue to meet with defeat. frequently, because of false pride, we give lip service and don't really mean the things we say. I hear people giving lip service to things around here and things that are said. Oh, yes, Mrs. Delaney, I agree with you. I certainly agree with you, and you know they don't, because you read the critiques, you read the various things that you write, you listen carefully, and you know that to my face you're agreeing, behind my back you disagree. You cannot lie too well in writing, and certainly your eyes, you're not good liars, believe me. Your eyes don't lie. At least they don't lie to me. So don't just give lip service. Of course, if you say a thing often enough, I am an alcoholic, I am an alcoholic, I am an alcoholic, one of these days you'll believe it. It's like writing cat 100 times. You know how to spell cat when you finish. And sometimes going through the motions is good. But do it without false pride. Do it because you are really trying. I hear so many people say here, well, I've had so much of AA, I know all the answers. I've been around AA so many years, or I've been to so many meetings, I know the answers. Well, you know all of them but one. How to stay sober. If you knew how to stay sober, you wouldn't be here. And obviously you don't know all the answers because you haven't been able to put one of the principles to work. Number one, that you're powerless over alcohol, that you can't drink. So don't tell me that you already know all the answers, because you don't. One of the second reason, I think, for our failures to recover is that some of you have lost confidence. Some of you are conditioned to failure. You have gone off the wagon so many times when you promised yourself that you wouldn't, that you get sort of used to failing. You rather expect to fail. But I don't like to see you have that sort of an attitude. Try to display some confidence in yourself. At least that you are willing to try. And that's a great asset, that you're willing to go through the motions of following a program without fighting, of taking notes, of trying to pray. This is one of the things people say, well, I never prayed in my life, or I don't know how to pray, or God didn't answer my prayers. Mine was, God helps those that help themselves, and I'm not doing anything about it, so why should I bother him? Well, I now know that somebody or something outside myself must have been watching out for me, or I'd have been dead. I tried it. I would have been listed as a suicide if I had died in San Francisco from an overdose of medication and alcohol. And suicide was the farthest thing from my mind. I just wanted to stay on my feet. Of course, I did it in a very peculiar manner. But I didn't know. And so, if you have lost confidence, try to say, well, at least I'm trying today, and have confidence that because other people have tried, they have won. You hear stories of the crippled all the time who have been told they would never walk again, and they do. So if you have suffered defeat at the hands of alcohol a good many times, don't say that you can't. Say, I will, because I want to, and I'm willing to ask for help. Another reason for failure is that you're too self-centered. Now, here we have to be careful of that word selfish, because again and again you'll hear that the AA program is a selfish program. This is true. Because you have to get this program for yourself, this way of life for yourself, this sobriety, this comfort, before you can be unselfish and give it to others. You cannot give away what you do not have yourself. But you do not have to carry your selfishness over to your family and say, I can't mow the yard because this is a selfish program and they told me to rest. I can't be disturbed in the morning by the children because they told me to rest. That isn't what the selfishness of the AA program says. Neither does it say that you shall be a doormat and sacrifice the welfare of your family by running out to AA affairs, 12th step work, in excess. We try to tell you moderation in all things save one, and that is there is no moderation in the intake of alcohol and medication. One is too many and 100's not enough. But we do need to have some moderation in our activities. Food, the right kind, at the right time. Not gorge yourself one meal a day, but distribute your protein diet throughout the day. This is moderation. Don't work until you're ready to drop. Work a little bit at a time. If you took 5 minutes out of every hour to sit down and completely relax, you'd be surprised what a wonderful job you can do today. When we are self-centered, we frequently have ideas about helping other people, but we say, oh, my neighbor's business is not mine. Well, I don't mean for you to run your neighbor's family, but if you see something that you can do, some little thing, maybe it isn't much, but it's the drop of water that filled the bucket. Do the little thing, not the big splashy thing, the little bitty thing. You boys, if your wife happens to like mints, bring her a package of mints once in a while. I'll never forget on a wedding anniversary when my husband forgot it and he said, you know, I'll give you $100, said he, on Sunday morning of my anniversary. You know what I told him to do with the $100, don't you? I'd rather he'd just leaned over and kissed me and said, honestly, honey, the days slipped by. Or if he'd have gone out in the yard and picked some dandelions, that would have been enough. The little things are important. And you folks who have children, it's the little things that they do for you. Appreciate them. Be sure that you do. When the youngster comes in with a little handful of grass or a little handful of dandelions, don't give him a dollar to go to the movies. Say thank you and put them in a glass. And enjoy them while you have a chance. Don't be selfish. You can be selfish by paying off a child. Don't be so self-centered that you want everything that you do to bring you praise. You know, I thought I was really quite a kid when I came in. I did so much for other people. But the only trouble is I did the right things for the wrong reasons. I did it so they'd say, "Isn't Jerry a wonderful person?" Because you see, I knew I wasn't. I knew I was selfish. But I did all these things hoping that I wouldn't find out. And that they didn't find out. And they didn't find out. But the only person I couldn't run away from was me. If I'd done those things because I really wanted to do something for them, and we must start doing the right things for the right reason. Another reason for our failure to recover from alcoholism and to become comfortable is that we become too dependent on props. I think Jerry Shulman said this in another way. We tried them, but I did all these things hoping that I wouldn't find out. And that they didn't find out. And they didn't find out. But the only person I couldn't run away from was me. If I'd done those things because I really wanted to do something for them, and we must start doing the right things for the right reason. Another reason for our failure to recover from alcoholism and to become comfortable is that we become too dependent on props. I think Jerry Shulman said this in another way. We try to lean on somebody. Lean on our husband, lean on our wife, lean on our family. Try to get other people to take care of the things that we really should do. And men do this in business. They come against something that's tough and they'll delegate it to Johnny. Johnny was always better at those things than I was. Try doing a few of the things that belong to you yourself. Stop being too dependent when the problem should be passed on to others. He's strong enough to pass it on. Here's another problem. We say, "Oh, well, he'd fuss if I'd give that to him. It's easier to do it myself." But people do this so often with children. They will not let children learn. They will not let other members of their family, employees, learn how to do things. Because it's easier to do it yourself than to teach them how to do it. We're frequently so irresponsible in money matters. Now, frequently people tell me when they come in here that they never had any financial trouble. When we were doing those Johns Hopkins questions the other night, I didn't have a single person object to the question on financial problems. And I'm sure everybody checked it no. But I wonder how many of you have come up to the end of the month and couldn't possibly balance your checkbook. And the bank sends a few checks around that you simply do not remember writing. If that's not financial trouble, maybe you weren't overdrawn. Maybe you were lucky enough not to be overdrawn. That doesn't mean you didn't have financial trouble. If any one of you tell me that you didn't spend money when you shouldn't have, all you're doing is lying to yourself. Certainly you had financial trouble. Oh, you glossed it over. But there never was a person who drank too much that wasn't irresponsible in money matters in some area. I managed not to write any bad checks, and I managed not to borrow money where I shouldn't have. But I lost a few sets of furs. That's not what I'm... My best act was to leave them in the taxi cab and never be able to find the taxi cab. But after all, I didn't really want them anyway. They were hardly worth picking up, you know. I bought them 2 weeks before. But I would have told you I was very responsible in money matters. I was so responsible, I spent every dime I could get my hands on. Sometimes we get to believing that someone will come to our rescue. Always. That somebody will pick up the pieces. And this goes on for quite a while. But all of a sudden, this comes to a screeching, roaring halt. And nobody will pick up your pieces. This particularly happens with women, who again and again push their husband right to the brink. And they always come around. And then all of a sudden they don't come around anymore. You girls who still have your husbands, better think about this a little bit. And I'd rather have a husband who gives you the devil every step of the way, or a wife who loves you enough to tell you, I'm going to leave you and mean it if you don't get sober, than I would the sweet, loving kind that takes you back again and again. Because all of a sudden, these are the kind, you know, that have been thinking slowly, cheerfully, until the water comes over their mouth, and then they're long gone. And they can't understand. I had a man say to me, I can't understand why my wife left me. She's always been so nice. She had had it. And let me tell you something, boy. There's nothing as dead as a dead love. It cannot be revived. So those of you who still have love in your heart, better take care of it. And let me tell you something. There's no better way to take care of it than starting with sobriety. Stay sober. That'll last a year anyway. And by that time, you'll be stable enough to be able to take their nervous breakdown that they have. And incidentally, some of the non-alcoholics will hold together quite well for a year. But unless they go to Al-Anon and unless they begin to build their own defenses, they fold up like a tent. When they regain their confidence in you, I've seen more wives and more husbands fold up when their alcoholic got good and stable and sober than you can shake a stick at. Those taut nerves, as they begin to let out, you've seen a rubber band that's been stretched around a pile of paper. When you take it off, it goes like this. And this is just about what happens to family members. So don't believe that somebody is always going to come to your rescue. Because eventually, the dead end shows up. Of course, one of the major things that keeps us from succeeding is our failure to have any sort of a spiritual life. Now, I'm not an organized religion person myself. I go to all churches. I'm very comfortable in all of them. To me, this is where God lives, as I understand. This is the place where people go to stand up and be counted. But because I did not belong to an organized religion, I was very uncomfortable in church. I didn't feel that I belonged. And my very good friend Bishop Dougherty made me very comfortable. He said, you know, if you went out to India and you were invited to the home of the Maharaja, and you went in and before dinner, everybody turned around three times and patted themselves on the top of the head and sat down cross-legged, you'd try to do the same thing because you were in the home of the Maharaja. And he said, don't make yourself conspicuous in the home of the Catholic Church or the Jewish synagogue or the Presbyterian Church by not following their customs. This is the ritual that they like in their home, and you follow it if you've been invited there. And if you are in the Catholic Church and people cross themselves, this is what you do. Or you try to follow it. You may be a little clumsy at first. But for goodness sake, try to be comfortable in somebody's home. You're welcome there. You've been invited. You are a guest. They like you. Be comfortable. And so I'm comfortable. I don't feel like I'm a hypocrite. I don't feel like I'm an unbeliever. I believe firmly in a power greater than I am, that I call God. Perhaps if I passed around papers right now and asked you to write on paper what God is, we'd get as many different answers as there are people in the room. And mine might not be the same as yours, but I believe. I have had help from outside myself. I have had help through people. I have had help from the most amazing places when I have wanted it, when I have sincerely asked for it. I had trouble believing that I could be forgiven for some of the things that I did during my drinking years. And then somebody said, what are you trying to do, play God? Obviously you've been forgiven or you wouldn't be alive now. Why don't you accept with gratitude the grace that has been given you? And grace to me means an unearned favor. Many of the favors I didn't earn, but they were given freely to me. And all I had to do was accept them gratefully. Some of you have failed in AA. Maybe you had the I nevers. Some of you didn't have the chance to hear that man, but I thought he was simply wonderful. He said, I always had the I nevers. I never went to jail. I never had a wreck in an automobile. I never went out with another man's wife. And then I went to AA, and I never joined a group, and I never attended regularly, and I never got sober. Maybe that's what's the matter with you. You got the I never on both ends. I think we should think a little bit tonight about what program of action you can take. You know, you can plan for tomorrow if you plan with flexibility. Being willing to change the plan if it does not prove successful on the day of execution. And I think all of you should have a plan for rejoining the community, because you will rejoin the community. What are you going to do to keep from falling back into the negative failure pattern? Are you going to go back and do just exactly what you did before you came in? Except that you aren't going to drink. Well, if you are, you're going to drink too, because it was the way of life that conned you into thinking that you could drink the last time, or the last 20 times, or the last 50 times. And so you should have some plan of action. Are you going to accept the suggestions and the advice of the winners? Or are you going to say, well, they're older than I am, they don't quite understand me? I was very different, you see. I wasn't quite like the other folks. I'm just about as different as two peas in a pod. Oh, maybe I came from Illinois and they came from Mississippi, but in the manner in which I behave, the essentials are the same. And so I had to begin to see how I, not see how I did not relate to these people, but how I did relate to them. What areas were similar? What things did they do that I could apply to my life? Now, how can I keep from applying it? How can I apply it to my daily living? We suggest also that you start right now trying to do one good deed a day and not get found out. Don't tell everybody how nice you were to Mary or John or what you did for him. Just do one little thing. You know, this business, well, she didn't do her half of the room, so I won't do mine. Or I did my half of the room, so hers is dirty, so what? Let Mrs. Delaney catch her, it'll be all right. I've heard this, too. I think, what? I must have struck a happy chord there someplace. I think if you want to be a winner, you might try to set a definite time each day for meditation. You know what meditation is in my book? It's listening. Quiet. We ask and we do, but we never just sit and listen. You know, today was a beautiful day, just walking around that circle. You could do a lot of listening. Just looking at the sky. Not talking, not keeping their mouth closed. There's some people around here that never shut their mouth. Dap, 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 dap. I, you know, like the broken record to get stuck on the machine. You hardly know you're talking. Try to have at least some time when you listen. During this time, you might review some of the positive things that you've heard during the day or the day before. And see if you couldn't apply them to you. Simple plans are the beginning of self-discipline. And certainly, we do need it. Summing up guidelines for contented sobriety coming about this order. Try to live in day-tight compartments just today. Accept your limitations and make the very best of the talents you have. Three, realize that mediocrity is overcome by hard work, not by daydreams. Four, strive not for protection, but just to live up to your particular capabilities. Five, seek every day to improve your goals and your standards and your sense of value. Six, strive to help other people who suffer as you do.